The following Dharma encounter with Ron Hogan Green Sensei took place at Zen Mountain Monastery at the conclusion to a week-long meditation session. As you'll hear, Dharma encounters begin with the introduction of a topic related to Zen practice and training. Students then volunteer to present their understanding of the topic or a question for the Dharma encounter teacher to reflect on. The presence of fellow students means that anyone in attendance can benefit from the exchange. We hope you enjoy.
Good morning, everybody. This is a Dharma encounter, a particular way that the teaching occurs in a Zen monastery. Its origins go back to the time of the Buddha, and I know there's a number of people here who have not experienced that before, so I'll be very brief, but a little explanatory. One of the ways that the teaching occurs is face-to-face teaching, Daisan Doksan interview in a small room, and it literally is face-to-face, and it's confidential, and no one else other than two people in the room know what is occurring. This is similar in that it is definitely face-to-face, and it is public, and so that gives us all an opportunity to see the exchange and to receive the offering that's being offered by the two people in that exchange. And the purpose of that exchange is identical to what happens in private interview, which is to help the student have greater insight into their original self nature. Sometimes the exchanges are directly pointing, and sometimes less so, sometimes a bit more conceptual, depending on what the student offers, where they're coming from, their experience. But as much as possible, it's intended to be pretty direct. It's an important part of practice, because in coming up, you're invited to go pretty much right to your edge and to offer out of that. That can be scary, intimidating, or not, but it's a helpful part of practice because ultimately this is what comes out of and directly facing us in Zazen. A degree of rawness, of wholeness, of seeing past our obstacles, and trusting ourselves, deeply trusting ourselves to put ourselves forward. Now, what I'm going to speak of today is based on the talk I gave yesterday, and some of you did not hear that, so I'll very briefly go through that and listen to it, because there are many opportunities to explore within it. So yesterday I took up a koan called the Wisdom of the Flower Garland Sutra. And in it, it says, in the Avatamsaka Sutra, Shakyamuni Buddha says, as I now see all sentient beings everywhere, they're endowed with the Tathagata, the Buddha's wisdom and virtue. And that is pointing to the inherent awakefulness that is a Buddha nature that's present in everybody, without exception. And then the sutra goes on, but because of deluded thoughts and attachments, they do not realize it. And so this is the business of realizing it, right here in this monastery and elsewhere. Because it is your family treasure, it is yours from the beginning. That's the understanding is not a great word, but the realization that comes from realizing yourself, that you're whole and complete from the beginning. So I took this koan and I tied it to a poem, which I'll now recite. It's a challenging poem, And the poem was originally probably, I don't know for sure, directed towards a specific person. And in consequence of what happened in that poem, they acted and took up certain vows. And I've simply broadened that, broke it open to include us all, not just from a personal one-to-one perspective, although it does not exclude that in any way, for us to share in and to look at from a broader Dharma, if you will, perspective. So the poem is called Listening by David Ignauto, who was a 20th century poet. And I'll make some comments along the way because I'm not going to repeat the talk, obviously. So just to invite you in if you did not hear the talk yesterday. You wept in your mother's arms, and I knew that from then on, I was to forget myself. Now, in each reference to a person here, they're all you. It's like a dream, as you may know. When you have a dream, you should consider it from the point, whatever the dream presents, that each is a projection of yourself. And in that section, perhaps it was meant literally, but for many of us, me included, I never wept in my mother's arms. She wouldn't have known what to do with that, and I wouldn't have occurred to me to do that. And there's a history there, obviously. But I've sure wept in her arms. Prajnaparamita, the mother of all Buddhas, in effect, the mother of our inherent realization and our ability to realize it. And I knew from then on I was to forget myself. And also present within that statement is the First Noble Truth, that life is suffering, and you're going to be faced with this, and what you do with that defines your life. Listening to your sobs, I was resolved against my will to do well by us. So you can begin to see what the response is of this poet to the suffering, perhaps in this case of someone he loved, but your suffering, my suffering, and our response to it. Listening to your sobs, I was resolved against my will, that's a key part, to do well by us. And so I said, without thinking, in great panic, I'm going to pause there, without thinking, where did that response come from? In great panic. Why in great panic? That's an interesting question. In great panic to do wrong against one's own judgment. To do wrong against one's own judgment. That relates to, but because of deluded thoughts and attachments, they do not realize it. What's that relationship? Is that to do wrong to one's own judgment? Or is it something else? To do wrong in one's own judgment, though others thrive by it. We live in a society which thrives out of our delusions and attachments and tangles them, bright, shiny objects before us. And inevitably, we're all affected by that. To do wrong in one's own judgment, though others thrive by it, is the right road to blessedness. Not to submit to error is in itself wrong and pride. What does that mean? How do you see that? Standing beside you, I took an oath to make your life simpler by complimenting mine. Do you hear that? Standing beside you. And what does standing beside you mean? anyway? Does it just mean physically next to another person? Mm-hmm. Is there something else going on? I took an oath. We know oaths. We do them all the time here. We do them every time we sit. We do them, we will do them today. We have done them today. I took an oath to make your life simpler by complicating mine. How is my life complicated by that oath? Is it complicated by that oath? And what I always thought would happen did. I was lifted up in joy. How remarkable. And what is that joy? Is it, whoopee, everything great? So there are many, many entry points in this. Again, three parts. The Buddha's offering. What stops us from realizing the Buddha's offering? And this poem, which is pointing how at a response to that koan. So how do you understand standing beside you? I took an oath to make your life simpler by complicating mine. How do you understand that? How do you see that? How is it alive or not in your life? Why would you do such a thing? Why would you take such an oath? How would you do such a thing? How do you understand to do wrong in one's own judgment, though others strive by it, is the right road to blessedness? Does that make sense? Is that a way to live? A way to avoid living? What is this blessedness that's being talked about? And what about not to submit to error is in itself wrong and pride? So those are just suggestions. You're invited to come at it from any way that makes, that you relate to, that raises a question or a comment or a thought. I'd like to invite especially people with some experience. There's a lot here. And I'd also like to invite anyone else who wants to come up and investigate it. The requirement is that you're participating in ANGO. In essence, your name is on that chart, the chart in the back. And so the line is open. We can't provide entertainment without a microphone, after all.
Shosanchi. Standing next to the other and complicating my life to make the other person's life or my partner's life simpler. It means to truly serve the other, to sometimes do what I think is not me, and I don't really want to do that. But while at the same time observing both our Buddha nature.
Well, I wouldn't say it's easy to do this with someone you love, but how about standing next to a nameless politician who you might not love?
Oh. I was actually once very humbled to give a treatment to a nameless politician without knowing. And the person was very kind. And in my judgment, he was in the wrong party. And I heard about this after. The person was very understanding, and actually he spoke very much from his heart. And So there, I was very humbled. And since then, I tried to leave that judgment out of the picture. It's also different to actually meet the person and not just how they're presented.
Well, what's the difference?
The difference.
Between meeting the person and how you saw it before you met the person?
You do feel their Buddha nature. And you then see the obscuring things, but the other thing is they are also in a person that does a lot of wrong.
That's really important. That in a fundamental way, what we may tend to accuse others of, we should start looking first with ourselves. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanshi, to not permit error is the greatest fault. This is a humbling awareness because it implies that in our brokenness is a greater understanding than the one that we think we have when we're striving for perfection. Is it that the act of striving is itself a kind of self-destructive behavior that pushes away this deeper understanding?
What do you mean by perfection?
I see all around me a competitive society, competitive world, chasing after the things of appetite. Is not perfection in that sense developing the most accomplishments and getting the biggest pile of stuff?
Well, it's a perspective, but I think it's a limited perspective from the Dharma. Because of karma. There is a fundamental justice in reality. Karma is, as I understand it, an immutable law. It will seldom, we have our moments where we can see instant karma from our actions and thoughts in that moment. But as the Buddha pointed out, nobody knows all that karma or the karma of a situation. And you can look at any situation, no matter how horrible, and what may later emerge from that, and say, oh, the good that emerged from that horror could have only emerged from that horror. That's one way, it's another way to look at it. I'm not pinning it down. But going back to what the broader question of you are asking, to the degree that we realize our true nature, one of the things we manifest is a sense of deep equanimity, profound equanimity, coming out of wisdom. A humbleness and a perspective and trust both of karma and our own humanness. And one of the examples I like to use, which you've heard before, is what sounds very much like me, a true story, is the Buddha sitting under the tree with the kingdom he was from and its armies marching down the road, and him knowing that, he sat under the tree in front of them. And they came to him and they saw the Buddha. And they turned around and went back home. And some time passed. And again, the king gathered his armies and came down the road. And again, the Buddha sat there. And this time they walked right by him. And death and horror ensued. And we should understand that unless you've been in war, we really don't know that horror. And particularly back in those times, battle was very, very personal. How do you think the Buddha felt at that moment?
Stabbed to the heart that they wouldn't listen?
I don't know. But I think a deep and profound acceptance of the suffering that was happening and about to happen. An acceptance. Not in the usual word of acceptance. In the usual word of understanding the First Noble Truth that he himself taught. And in a strange, if not funny way, a respect for these people creating their own karma. Because it's theirs. And it will inevitably play out in the way it plays out. And so I take that up in a most personal way. I can't save anybody.
Oh.
I don't think you can save anybody. We can help, we can offer, assuming there's some permission or opportunity to do that skillfully. But their karma is their karma. And I'm not saying don't do everything you can to prevent what you know to turn into horror. Yes. And we have a responsibility to do that.
Yes.
A deep responsibility. And yet, to try and fix someone in the name of you know something that they don't.
Yes.
Is a transgression.
I understand. Thank
you. May life go well.
Thank you for your teaching. Shosanji, I actually wasn't going to come up here today, but something you said really kind of grabbed a hold of me from the poem. And I can't remember the line, but it was in the crying arms of your mother. And you said how you thought about your own mother and she wouldn't have known what to do with that.
Well, it's a stepmother.
Well, still,
yeah.
It's the mother you grew up with.
Yeah.
But, you know, I could so identify with that because, you know, I was in the middle of three children, and when my younger sister was born, I was six. And up until that point, I was like...
You were the star.
I was the center of the universe. And then when she was born, for some reason, my mother just... abandonment, you know, and that was like that for the rest of her life. And it was hard, you know, and I sometimes, you know, and then what you said, you've cried in the arms of Prajnaparamita. And, you know, when you said that, I was thinking about all the times that I've thought about, you know, what am I doing? You know, does this work? Why am I spending so much time doing this? And it just felt like I was hitting my head against the brick wall. And yet, you know, looking back, it was the loving arms of Ava and Prajnaparamita that really kept me here. And, you know, it's so often you can't see that. And I was thinking about a quote from the Ojibwe, who was the chief of the Ojibwe tribe up in the Great Lakes. And he said, sometimes I go about pitying myself when all the while I'm being carried upon great winds across the sky. And it feels like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I have a question, but
yeah.
I just felt like I needed to talk today. So
thank you for doing that. You know, one of the things is through this practice and through our experience of the practice, really, that's important to cultivate and difficult to talk about is great faith. Great faith. And I'm just going to speak out of my own experience. when that is there in a particular way, it does not matter what happens to me, because my faith is not dependent on the good and the bad, and for sure the good and the bad will come. You know, I'm relatively old. Either I'm going to die or my wife is going to die first. And I've thought about that many times. But it's in a different way, not a problem. In fact, it's kind of natural. It is natural. And to have that deep faith in the Dharma allows me to, my pet phrase, which probably we've all heard me say, is to turn everything towards the Dharma. Turn no matter what comes towards that, towards bringing my life and my practice into those circumstances. And, you know, that sounds so cliche, as bring your practice into your circumstances, but it's not. And you have to dig deep, because life hurts deeply sometimes. And yet, what happened was I was lifted up in joy. And that joy is not a whoopee. Hallelujah, this is wonderful. It's something much more profound than that.
Yeah, sometimes I, you know, I get these glimpses of how my life has changed. And it's very subtle sometimes. And,
yes.
You know, I think I was just you know, I just, there is a joy. But it's not like that whoopee joy that you talk about. It's just kind of a, this equanimity, really, more than joy. And, you know, it's not there all the time. But some days it's very strong. And I just feel such gratitude when I can feel that.
Me too. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanshi, thank you for this poem. And I want to thank the seniors before me coming up to reveal themselves so this wisdom could come.
Yes. In spite of ourselves.
Exactly. That's the line that really, like, hit me so strongly. I sometimes get these little phrases that come up in my head that help me question myself quite imperfectly, but and it was against my better judgment. Is that the line in there?
Yeah.
Right. The question that came up for me was, I had this little phrase that was saying, "I'm done." And I was like, "I'm done with what?" You know, like, that was my response to myself. So what is my better judgment in that moment? What is it exactly that I'm done with? I'm asking. Yosha talked this week about cultivating that great doubt. You know, that great doubt that that I have to have anything in any moment in order to survive it. You know? And so this acting against my better judgment, which is my reactivity, right? My sadness over my karma and all that I have created, and the possibility for what could come.
You know, what saves our ass from our karma is that although it's a law of the universe, we are creating tomorrow's karma right now.
Yeah.
And strangely enough, and I won't go into it, the karma of the present obviously goes forward, but it also goes back in time and space. And within that, what you do and how you do it, how you think, and almost all enables all possibilities for you. You know, one of the blessings of being old and being around this place for a long time is seeing all these white robe folks, all these Dharma holders, senior practitioners, when they, like me, what kind of jerks? No offense. It's just, you know, it's just one jerk speaking to another. But the practice changes that karma. Not just the practice, the desire to practice and the desire to awaken. Desire, when I say jerk, the desire to stop hurting others and ourselves. Yeah. And that desire is something we can always rely on. I mean, you know the name of it, bodhicitta. But it's in a way more personal than that, more specific than that.
Yes.
And it's completely reliable. Completely reliable. And that's the deep faith that I was talking about. Unerringly reliable. May not be in the way that we're planning or think or it should be. Those are the delusions that the Buddha was talking about. But, and so we can all name incidents of our life. And as you know, I had to leave the monastery at a certain point because of my personal situation that my wife was suffering. And that seems like a dead end, doesn't it? I'm far away. I have to work. There's no possibility for several years of coming here, etc., etc. And somehow along the way I discovered that in the midst of doing a job that at a certain level I really despised but was necessary, I can manifest what this place and you and my teachers have given me. It's not mine, it's mine to offer. There's a big difference between the two. Because it's not mine. So. And so that's true of all of us, appropriate to our own situation, to what we deeply want, to what our karma is, and what we're going to do with that. And that is my understanding of taking whatever becomes before me and turning it towards the Dharma. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanshi. The poem that you read speaks about panic.
I see you didn't miss it.
Yeah. And that's curious to me because it's presented in the poem as the way in. Mm-hmm. But it's like, that's so close to fear.
It is. There's an element of that, right?
Yeah. And there's a lot of fear that stops me from entering. And like, yeah, that where is the are those the same? Are they different? Like what is that?
Is that a Dharma joke? Are those
what?
The same or different?
Ha ha.
So what are you doing here? Weren't you afraid to come up?
Yes. As soon as I got online, I was like, you stupid fucking idiot. What are you doing? There was an empty Zabaton right next to me in line. I was like, maybe if I just kind of scoot over here, no one will notice.
Here you are.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem to be a problem.
No.
But why the panic? Why do you think?
Well,
what is happening? Put yourself there.
Yeah.
In that moment, something you didn't know about before, that moment of seeing the deep suffering, perhaps someone you love, but not necessarily, that's my point of the poem, something changed. I mean, in another way, nothing changed. Something was revealed to you about yourself. Why should that cause panic? What's at risk here?
Opportunity?
Yeah, but maybe disaster. You don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Not at all. Neither do I. Although I have faith in whatever happens. But imagine in that situation where something undeniable is opened in you. Can't be denied. And yet the realization along with that, that everything you've based your life on, isn't going to hold. If that doesn't scare the shit out of you, I don't know what will. And yet you have to respond. Just like coming up here. Just like going to Daiso. Just like life. You have to respond. And how you respond makes all the difference in the world. And where that comes from, that response, makes all the difference in the world. So you saw how you responded. And you saw what came out of that in the poem. But we don't always live happily ever after. Although there's an element of that in a true and deep dedication to your waking up and practicing that. But, you know, given all that, you know, tomorrow you get ALS or fill in the blanks. And yet given that, that doesn't stop you either. And, you know, we've had enough examples here, and certainly many in my life, of people who are dying being more alive than in any other time in their life. And we've had other people, practitioners, dying and screaming against the hell that has descended upon them. Ultimately, there's nothing to say about that. It is simply what it is. But nothing happens without a series of events, the karmic precursors, if you will, to that particular moment. And so, at least for me, that's the panic, the desperation. And somebody once said to me after I started teaching, and I said, then they asked me a question about how I practice, why I practice, and I said, I'm desperate. And they said to me, after all these years of practice, you're desperate? Yes. Yes. That's alive. I'm desperate. The difference is I'm a little more desperate for you to realize it than I am for me. Because good things have happened for me out of that desperation. And I want to offer that. And you need that desperation. It's hard to go deeply in yourself, just doing business as usual. And we all approach the practice in our Zen, business as usual, right? And usual means, how can I be most comfortable?
Totally, it's like, okay, silent stillness, like, got it. I'm just gonna sit here and like, right. Hang out and watch.
And I can't tell you how many times I've heard Shugen Roshi in the middle of a session basically say, these are my words, not his. Stop being so comfortable. You know, find your edge. Don't go off your edge, but find your edge. Find where it's working for you, you're comfortable, and what's more, what more is there?
The fear is like, oh, I'm not going to be comfortable anymore. I'm going to lose that. But the panic is like, if I just stay comfortable, I'm just going to be comfortable and then die.
Exactly. You got it. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
So, Sanji.
So, this morning, kind of took in that poem, well, at least a particular part of it, about that mother, about the weeping child. And a great big huge ball of this came out of it. You know, some 52 years ago, a woman pregnant with me left a place called Karl-Marx-Stadt in Germany. Gave me up for adoption. She landed in Texas, gave me up for adoption, and I never really knew her at all. But whatever she did for me, because from what I heard from my parents, she wanted me to be born here in America so I could have American citizenship. And I grew up with this concept of, okay, I'm adopted. What does this mean? I'm well taken care of, da-da-da-da. I'm neurodivergent, so I process things a bit differently than a lot of other people do. Sometimes I'm very slow to process things. Right relationships, I can barely get ordinary relationships figured out. So I was not the best kid, you know, not the best son to my mother. You know, I would, you know, my parents were dad got stationed over in Germany for a number of years. And I would just off on a whim, five Deutschmarks. I'm going to take a 7-hour bus ride around southern Germany. You know, 7-year-old kid just doing this, you know, and not listening to my mom, not honoring them, you know, that's the thing. Like honoring your father and your mother so that your life may be well on the land. You know, and I'm like, okay, well, I do a thing. Yeah. Mom yells at me, dad. What's my point? There's a lot of grief that I have about this, and I don't know how I've managed to live as long as I have without processing it properly. I mean, when my mother was dying and sick, I should have been there by her bedside the whole time, but I ran from that. She passed on, from what I understand, by herself, and I'm just a shit person for doing that. You know, how could anyone in their right mind do that? Leave their mother to die. And she took care of me. When I had the thing in my eye where I panicked, and you know, my mother was also, she had disabilities. I won't really elaborate on what those were, but she had some trouble functioning in her older age, like most people do. So in spite of all that, she took me and held me and got me on a train. She rode together with me, and she barely knew how to work the MTA train ticket thing, you know. So however all these things came together, we got down to Manhattan Eye, Ear, Nose, Throat Hospital. They did some surgery in my eye, and I still see. And yet I did that to her, you know. And I'm like... You know, and hearing you, like, describe crying into, you know, her arms. And I was like, why did I have such a good life? You know, why did I come to this, you know, to be here today? You know.
You came to this so that you could help yourself and others in the very situation you're describing. Do you understand?
Yeah, I want to do that.
That's your job.
Yeah.
That is your job. You have a child who's got some significant problems. Mm. How will you help her?
Yeah.
You've got an ex-spouse. Mm. There's some wounds there. How will you help her?
Yeah.
You have some wounds. How will you help that, aside from crying?
Yeah, crying just gets it out, but, you know, you're right. How do I navigate that?
But there's no, oh, first I do this, second I do that. That's not what it's about. It's an open process, because you're an open process. And so you know, however subtly, we don't want our pain. Mm. But to be responsible for our pain in a way that we offer it to ourselves and others is a whole other ballgame. And you know that. I know you know that. And yet sometimes we forget.
Yeah.
So come back to it. Come back to what holds you. You know those things. Mm-hmm. Come back to working with yourself, to your practice. Come back to looking, even if there's nothing you can do directly to your mother. There are some things you can do. That's a slightly different story. Yeah. You can do to others in repayment for your mother. Mm. Yeah. One other kind of practical thing, which is not a fix, but is real, is to express what you need to express to her. Write it.
Yeah.
Put it on your altar. Mm. And each time you said, may your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanshi, the one whose life is made simpler is simple, and the one whose life is made complicated are right here.
Absolutely.
And sometimes that seems harmonious in its way. The simplicity is placed at the center. The complication happens and is maybe manageable. But most of the time, not. I feel such conflict, and it is panic-inducing. How does the one who is willing to take on the complication for the one
who's confused,
who is confused and who deeply needs that simplicity, how is that confusion settled?
Yeah. What's the confusion? What is it?
I don't know. It's like it feels more like this than like this.
Yeah. You might start with the second noble truth. What am I saying?
Knowing that I can actually...
That's the third.
Knowing that I did actually create my own suffering.
Well, that's certainly true. But I'm asking, what about that? What's the dynamic that's going on that's creating the confusion? And it sounds like I'm speaking from a knowing, but I'm only knowing in a general sense. The specifics are yours. And I only know because I know from my own confusion. But what is the second noble truth? What causes?
The kleshas.
Can you be more specific?
Greed, anger, ignorance.
Yeah, the Buddha's pretty specific. I mean, he was even more specific than that, although that's representative. Called it desires are endless. I vow to put an end to them. And of course, within those desires is everything else that you're pointing to. So another way to frame that in modern psychological terms is, when you're confused, what do you want that is not actually happening? Put it another way. How is what's actually happening different from where you're placing yourself?
When I first came here, I believed that I came here not because I was suffering, but because I wanted to understand reality. Mm-hmm. It took me years to hear myself crying.
And sometimes people say that, and to be honest, I try not to roll my eyes, but I'm sometimes not successful.
You know,
every human being encounters that.
A well-placed eye roll is appreciated, actually.
Yeah, but it's loaded. It's loaded. I'm loading it. Unpack what I just said, if you can. You want me to repeat it?
Yes, please.
Desires are inexhaustible. The cause of our suffering, that's the cause of our suffering. Another way to frame that is what is happening now, this moment that is before us at any given time. We're not accepting. We want something different. Is that familiar?
Yes. I would like to be a less complicated person.
Yeah. We'll start with that. I mean, I say start with that, but actually, it's the whole thing. I mean, look what the Buddha said. Yeah, you're great, you're perfect, complete, lacking nothing. And?
Yeah, a little room for improvement.
Right.
Lots of room for improvement. Yeah,
but nothing you can't do. And to do that, you have to be willing, in whatever gradual and appropriate way to you and to your life and to your personality and to your abilities to do it. I mean, it's not something you fix. It's not something, oh, yeah, now I got it. It's not like that. You know it's not like that. But you have to fight for your life here. You have to fight for your life. So pick up our sword. You know what sword I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
And fight for your life. May your life go well.
Thank you, great teacher.
When I got online, and then realized there wasn't room online, and Kian sent me back and was like, I'll come get you if there's room. I was like, oh, thank God. Probably for the best. And then when I got called back, that was just against my better judgment.
So go away. But you ain't going away.
Speaking of this line that seems to get all of us, crying in your mother's arms. When I was little, my father used to make fun of the way I cried. He used to make me cry. And my lower lip used to tremble when I started crying, and he would make fun of me, tell me to grow up, that it looked ridiculous. And then after that, for 10 plus years, as you know, I was forced to take a lot of psychiatric medication against my will that numbed me and pushed me down. And the thing that I don't want to do is cry in front of everyone. But I kind of came with you to just take a minute to do that. Because maybe someone who needs that, maybe someone who needs that space, will have it cut through them like it cuts through me.
Thank you.
And that's the offering I want to make, especially after you just spoke of Indra's net. I want to offer this to meet that space and to help myself and to help anyone else who needs this. All I want to do is heal people so deeply. But for that, what was pushed down so intensely, to be able to spring back tenfold, This is how I heal myself and others.
For years, I've been wanting to master Zazen, you know.
Would just, anyone here who masters Zazen please raise their hand?
But just being able to sleep on time and then wake up not feeling like shit is an accomplishment. I've come to understand Zazen is designed to always push my edge, and it's not like I'm not feeling stronger doing Zazen, but me being stronger just means I get to, now I get to carry two packs, maybe. And you know, you say the complexity is in the poem, and you know, carrying two packs or more is such a relief. It makes me so happy.
An honest person is hard to find. May your life go on.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanji. I've always been quite reluctant to participate in this particular activity. And the poem is, I guess I'd be an understatement to say that there's an awful lot in that poem. The thing that I sort of was, I don't know, attracted to, I can't even remember the lines specifically, but it has to do with errors. So being concerned or afraid, me being concerned or afraid of making an error or making a mistake is what I paid the most attention to. And I think I understand that it's kind of an upside down inversion. Maybe it's not an inversion, but this issue of pride and how not wanting to make a mistake or being and turning that into fear is some kind of a not admitting or not recognizing my own pride. And that I think I remember that someone asked Shunryu Suzuki something about how he, his life, and how he felt about what he had undertaken and accomplished. And he responded that his life was one continuous mistake. And so, if I am to serve, I have to embrace the mistake and actually be grateful for it.
So I guess I don't have a question. How do I get out of this?
What does getting out of this mean?
Well, what it meant was, it's related to what I just said, you know?
Another continuous mistake, in other words.
Well, an aversion, I have an aversion to my perception of being the center of attention. Mm-hmm. And so getting out of this, that's what that was about.
Well, I'm very glad you came up. I've known you a long time. I've never seen you up here. I don't know if you've ever come up here or not.
Yeah, once or twice.
There's no insight without mistakes. Can't happen. You know why?
Do I know why?
Yeah. There's no compassion without mistakes.
I don't know what. There's no compassion without mistakes.
I mean, real mistakes. And your willingness to take those mistakes and see, oh, this is stopping me from doing something that at some level I know I need to do, changes that mistake into something really valuable. Do you understand that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, there's the mistake, which is, you know, in an ordinary sense, karmically leads to another mistake, leads to another mistake, leads to another mistake. Whatever pattern that is turning away from your true self and creating greed, anger, and delusion in some subtle or overt way. But you can't see that. You can't see into that without it occurring. And so this practice, in my experience, unerringly, when is relevant, because that depends on your karma and many other circumstances, but unerringly shows you that. And then what are you going to do? And, you know, in my personality, I go right there. That's just the way this particular person is built. I don't recommend that for everybody. But what I've found is for me, because I so desperately want to awaken and help others, that seems the quickest, easiest way. Mm-hmm. Hurts like hell, but it's effective. So it's a long-winded way of saying that no matter what it is, if you practice it and work with it and see into it and acknowledge it, you know, in a sense, again, loaded words, be responsible for it. Mm-hmm. It will unerringly show you how to, quote, get out of it. Mm-hmm. And which, of course, you know, you can't get out of it.
There's no getting out.
No getting out. That door, that ship has sailed. How many years you've been doing this?
Set a question. Yes.
A long time.
25, 30, yeah. I don't know.
Ship's long gone.
Maybe longer.
Right, exactly. And here you are, seeing something into yourself, which never stops. Mm. We are so lucky. Thank you for your practice.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanchi. I was really inspired by your precepts retreat, and also I was just annoyed with myself, and so I thought, Melissa, what if for this session we just try dropping our bullshit? And particularly in like face-to-face teaching, because in the past maybe I just wouldn't go, because I'm like, oh, I really just need a practice at this point, or just ask like a curiosity, or if I did bring myself, I'm thinking of myself as like this fragile little egg with the yolk blown out, and I would like put a little box around it and put some cushion in it so I could like ask the question and like take the information back and like keep everything fairly tidy. So this time I was like, I'll just take in the egg, everything that I deeply feel is true and think and believe in my blood and sweat and tears and deepest practice, and I'll bring that in. And my experience with the teacher ever so gently takes that and crushes it and throws it on the floor. And that is quite unpleasant.
And
here I'm doing it again.
How come? Are you a masochist?
I think
so.
No, I'm coming because I trust what that is inside me that brought me into the teacher, that brought me up here, and I have a deep trust in you that you're going to help me see what I don't see. And I thank you for walking this road before me, and for teaching and listening. And I know that if I responded to that by flinging myself back into despair or a comprehensive analysis of better ways to live a life, that would just be back on my bullshit. And that's not what I'm here for. I know what I'm here for.
I know you do. But your thanks is slightly misplaced. I'll provisionally accept it on the basis of both my ego and all those who gave it to me. You're the one who deserves the credit. You're here. You're facing yourself. Those are your tears in your eyes. It's no small thing. That's at the heart of this practice. And the willingness to do that, which includes the willingness not to do that, and the fear of doing that, the times you can't do it, and the times you can, is the practice. Nothing's excluded from that. As long as there's a desire to, however you understand this, awaken. And that will carry you if you trust that. And you're learning to trust it. You're relatively new to this practice, but you're in it. And it's like stepping into deep mud with boots. You can't get out of it. So good luck, and keep going. Keep trusting, keep cultivating that faith. Appropriate to you. Appropriate to your circumstance. You understand? I think you do. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
I just remember that the protocol might have been that I should have opened that up, but...
You know what I think about protocol, right? It's gotten me in so much trouble, but anyway.
And I love you for that and so many other things. Shosanshi, with great resolve, I took the precepts many years ago, a very new practitioner. And it was in that first session right after Jikai that the thought came to me that I can't be an asshole just for the hell of it anymore. And it was like the ground opened up.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh no.
Oh shit.
Here we go.
That's in the poem, you know, on the lines, right?
I think so, yeah. And then it was with great panic that Shugan Roshi accepted me as a postulant. And it was kind of funny, my hands got cold, and I was like, oh my God, Oh yeah, I told him my hands are cold. He just laughed. He just grabbed my hands. He just laughed. But it was, you know, I did this to myself. And at the same time, it's like, I don't know, that I had no choice is not really the right words. There's always choice. And yet, how can I not respond? That's in the poem somewhere too. What is that edge of great panic that I wonder about? I've been kind of trying to track it in myself, you know, the anxiety that comes along with, you know, self. Because just responding, there's no panic. Maybe the panic's before, after, and during, but the actual responding, I wonder about that. Where is that coming from? Not that I need to know.
Yeah, I think you do need to know. So I'll say, I think, at this point, two things. The lesser of them is what Daito Roshi used to say, and I'll bet you heard him say it. If everyone around you is cool and calm, and you're panicking, no, he said it the other way. If everyone around you is panicking, and you're cool and calm, maybe you're missing something.
Yeah. Yeah. And the world is on fire.
So, well, but I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about appropriate response. And there is nothing wrong with panic in and of itself. So usually we look at, from a Zen perspective, panic, oh shit, you know, it's tied to anxiety, it's tied to fear, it's tied to demands. And that's one aspect. But look how he uses panic in this poem. He turned it towards what I would say the Dharma, but what he would say towards love, perhaps, and towards a vow.
Oh, yeah. I heard that the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference.
Yeah.
And, you know, when there's love, there's a little panic.
Yes. Yeah.
Maybe a lot.
And also, what's the context for us to practice, for us to realize ourselves just about how to help other beings? It's a human context. As previously talked about, we're going to make mistakes. We're going to hurt people with the best of intentions. I'm not the only one who's ever done that. Everybody in this room has probably done that to one degree or another. Whether we'll be aware of it or not, or that's important to us, is a whole other question. You know, I'm going to misquote, I suspect, Lincoln. You can help. I may screw this up, but you can help some of the people some of the time. You can help all of the people some of the time. But you can't help all the people all the time.
That's
right?
Probably fairly accurate.
And that doesn't mean I'm not responsible for it or I can't learn from it. But in our vows to offer our practice, we're doing our human best that we can. And when the result is not so helpful or harmful, what we do then makes all the difference in the world. Mm-hmm. How we use that instead of being used by it. Because it feeds right into all of our insecurities and projections and demands, right? When we hurt somebody and I'm supposed to have this vow and da-da-da-da. But there's another party there with other karma. And so, by its nature, in this relative world, we do the best we can. And also, we're not always given to know, maybe never given to know, how we're helping or hurting someone. It plays out over time. Right? How many people have we seen leave here in sometimes an utter disgust and hostility, and 10 years later they come back and say, oh, now I see what's here, or I can see what's here. So we're human beings, and we work within those non-limitations, because they're not there. That's what the Buddha was saying. But we create them as human beings, and that should be deeply respected as our karma, as our individual life, and as an opportunity, mainly as an opportunity. And that's how the grass grows.
Yeah. Being there with trust.
Any questions?
I don't know.
Well.
Do I need one? How do you stand with someone, not knowing where they are?
So that's the crux, not knowing where they are? You always know where they are. They're right here. They're you. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
I was just considering the fearlessness among the fear of people who come up and be vulnerable. And in that vulnerability, a wonderful thing can happen. I'll share something that maybe is slightly inappropriate, but in the wouldn't be the first time. In the retreat, I was speaking of the student-teacher relationship. And in my innocence, true innocence, I said, when the person comes before the teacher and they're naked, and the teacher is naked, magic happens. And the room, like now, burst into laughter. And I didn't get it. And then I thought about it, and I go, oh, that wasn't the most skillful way. But it's true in a different way. And, okay, this is humanness, true humanness. And it holds all of us. So thank you. Thank you for listening, for considering, for whether you came up or not, to open up to it, I hope. And that affects all of us far beyond what we would know. It certainly affects me. And I thank you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.